Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
Our founding fathers gathered in taverns to enjoy lively political conversation over a local brew, and so do we. It's a special Pints and Politics edition of River to River, presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. Today, coming to you from Millstream Brewing in Amana, I'm Ben Kiefer.
And I'm Erin Jordan. All right, so we want to introduce our panelists tonight. First, we've got on my far left here, Adam Sullivan, Gazette columnist. Jim Lynch, Gazette political reporter. Linda Waddington, Gazette columnist. Todd Dorman, Gazette editorial editor. And
Diane Bystrom is our special guest director of the Carrie Chapman Katz Center for Women and Politics at Iowa State University. She has been there in that position since 1996. Also, the Leadership Studies program at ISU since 2008. Diane Bystrom, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
I know you at the Gazette and we at Iowa Public Radio have turned to Diane so many times over the years for her political profundity and
expertise.
Yeah, that was. Yeah. Diane, you'll be retiring soon.
Yes.
And we'll wish you well in your retirement. We want to just ask you a few things sure. About reflecting on the time that you have covered in politics in your position and the interesting times in which we live today.
Sure.
So 2018 has brought a wave of female candidates into politics from both parties and across the country. I've talked to you before, and I know others have, about the different political styles you might see between male and female candidates. Mm-hmm. Wondered if you might talk about that a little bit.
Sure. What we've seen, and that's kind of the thrust of my research, which started actually in the 1992 election. For those of you that remember that election, it was forever dubbed the Year of the Woman. Just happened to be the election year I studied for my dissertation. So I did look at campaign ads and female and male video style. And actually what I found is over time, as I've continued that, there was a distinct different style in 1992 in women running for the Senate and governorships across the country. But what we've seen over the years, and I've studied every election cycle and the ads, we've seen a growing similarity when men run against women. They're sort of drawn into this narrative that we call tough but caring. And so women are trying to show they're tough, men are trying to show they're caring. But we have seen some new emerging differences since 2014. And that can be characterized as sort of an embrace of motherhood by female candidates. And so we saw that in 2014, actually with Joni Ernst, who was a veteran, a conservative, and a mom. And so we had some Republican women embracing that in 2014. It wasn't statistically significant, but it was something we started seeing. So you go around to this election cycle, you have women gubernatorial candidates breastfeeding in their ads. You have women talking about being moms. And they've also tested this strategy, and it does very well with voters. You know, some women have even said, I'm a mom. What better preparation is that for dealing with people in Congress?
Diane, I wanted to ask you about this week's news. The latest primary included the state of New York, and we had the headline there that a 28-year-old Bernie Sanders, former Bernie Sanders organizer, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, surprised a veteran Democrat in Brooklyn in that district, unseating him. I don't know, what are your observations about that surprise to the Democratic Party and how the Democratic Party is going to need to deal with a progressive wing? Will it be as strong as it was in 2016 in the next election, in the 2018 and 2020? What do you think?
I think she's a great example for someone who fit her district. And so if you look at that district, it's increasingly made up of minority voters. And so I think I saw it was like 45% African-American, 25%. I mean, it's a majority minority voters. The other thing I think, so she's, I think, a tale of fitting her district. The other thing that I think is exciting, two other things. Not only are more women running across the country, we're seeing a lot of younger women run as a result of the 2016 election, women that may have just stayed home before, so women that want to be activists. And the other thing that we're seeing is that money doesn't always win elections. He spent 18 times more than she did, and she got out there. And this, and I think there's two strategies emerging now. And one strategy that you see is that let's expand the base. Let's expand, let's get young people out to vote, let's get more minorities. So there's sort of this expanding the base strategy that some Democrats are embracing, and I think it worked for her.
What if you would transplant that candidate to Iowa? You mentioned Brooklyn, very diverse, much more diverse than any district here in Iowa. Would she have done well here in Iowa?
Probably not, and I don't know if you read it. There was a lot of blowback on Twitter. I think Time magazine came out the next day and said, oh, great win in New York, but what would that mean in the Iowa third or the Michigan something else? And like, okay, well, you need to fit your district. And so we do have two women candidates running for Congress, and I think, you know, Abby Finkenauer, you know, they were saying that she might be the youngest woman elected, but I think she'll be a little bit older than the New York City candidate. And you're great on pronouncing her name. I'm glad you're doing it and not making me pronounce her name. But I don't think she would particularly fit the Iowa. But we do have Abby Finkenauer, another 28-year-old. I think she'll be 29 by the time the election rolls around. And she's very young, and she's in the first district. And I think she comes from more of a working class background, and I think she fits the district.
The message is the same, though.
Yeah.
These two young women are saying the working class has been shafted.
Yes, and I think that is a really good message this year, particularly for women. There's polling, you know, there's lots of women running, but there's also polling on the other side of the equation, and that's with voters. And voters are very accepting of women candidates this year, including women of color. It's a record number of women of color are actually winning their primaries and will be on the ballot in the general election. Younger women are winning, and I think the voters right now, it's going to be a change election anyway. It would have been a change election no matter what happened, because midterms typically are. But I think voters are really seeing women as agents of change. That's something, a positive stereotype that women have. And so I think they're wanting to vote for women because I see that as a positive change.
Thank you, Diane. We want to open up the conversation here to our entire panel to talk about the big news of the week, which is, of course, the announcement of the resignation of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. He's going to be retiring July 31st. So he was a Reagan appointee, but often considered a swing vote on the Supreme Court. But most people believe President Trump will appoint a conservative. Is this a victory to some? I mean, this is obviously a victory to some, but a loss for others. Wanted to find out what kind of impact this could have on some significant cases that might come before the court in the coming years.
Well, I think you're right in that he will, whoever replaces Kennedy will be more conservative. And I think it's worth remembering that Kennedy is a conservative. He may have been more moderate than some members of the court, but he was a conservative when he was appointed, and he's considerably more conservative than that, what we call the liberal wing of the court. You know, so chances are whoever is appointed or confirmed is going to be there for 30 years or so and will have an impact. If you think about cases, some of the cases that this court, this term, sort of punted on, gerrymandering, the wedding cake case, those sorts of things are probably eventually going to come back to the court. And instead of punting on those things, there may be a 5-4 verdict that conservatives will like.
Let me remind our listeners who may have just joined us, you're listening to a special edition of River to River, Pints in Politics, alongside the Mill Stream or the Mill Race in Amana, Iowa, with my co-host Aaron Jordan of the Gazette, James Lynch, Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, Adam Sullivan, and our special guest Diane Bystrom, talking at this moment about the retirement of Anthony Kennedy. One of our questioners here on the lawn of the Millstream Brewing Company here asks how this will shape the 2018 midterm election. It's put a new spin on it, particularly with the fight, the battle to come in the nominee and that confirmation process.
Okay, I'll start. I think it's going to affect it a lot. And I think one thing that might happen is that I think if the Republicans go through with trying to push someone through. The Democrats are arguing that it's an election year. You didn't want to push it through with Merrick Garland. I do think if the Republicans push it through, I do think it's going to get Democratic voters, including young people, excited to turn out to vote. I think if the Democrats are successful with some help of a few Republicans to delay it after the election, that will also get Republicans that want to change the vote out to vote. So I think that will be the impact on the turnout.
Well, and I think as far as the impact on future cases, if my inbox is any indication, there's a lot of conservative groups that are excited about the prospect of overturning Roe versus Wade in some way with a conservative court. I've also gotten emails today from folks who want to revisit the marriage issue, who with Kennedy gone, think that they can go back and have a court majority that will then basically find that same-sex marriage isn't the law of the land. So you're going to see efforts to turn the clock back on both of those issues and probably a lot of other issues where the court has been more progressive in over the last 20 years.
It's important to remember it's a long appointment, and there's some speculation that Trump is definitely looking for a very young justice. And Kennedy's a perfect example. People change once they get on the court. Even Neil Gorsuch, he was very much hailed as a very conservative member when he was nominated. And he actually, by some measures, was less conservative than Kennedy this past year. And so that certainly could happen. It could be that there's a huge right swing on it, but it could also be that there could be emerge another swing voter, which could be John Roberts, it could be Neil Gorsuch, or it could be this new person.
So Senator Chuck Grassley, as head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, could you talk a little bit about the role that he has in this process and what position he has to speed this along, if that's what he desires?
Well, he has to defer to Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader. But yeah, Senator Grassley, as chairman of the Judiciary Committee, is a key player in this. And he's indicated that he wants to have hearings within weeks, not months, suggesting that perhaps Republicans will try to confirm a new justice before the election, which, as Diane said, probably will really motivate Democrats. I think there's some motivation for Republicans and conservatives who held their nose and voted for Donald Trump because of court appointments. And so far, they've really gotten what they wanted in the nomination and confirmation of federal judges, Supreme Court Justice Gorsuch, and others who are conservative. If you follow the Federalist Society, almost all of the judges that have been confirmed since Trump became president have been recommended and approved by the Federalist Society, which is a very, I guess you would say, a conservative legal group. So I expect that with Grassley, it'll be full speed ahead as soon as the president nominates someone.
Yeah, and I think they'll push ahead, quickly. The only drama will be in a floor vote is whether your sort of more moderate and retiring senators, your Jeff Flakes and John McCain's and others will balk at a very conservative choice, or whether the president will try to pick someone that's more in the mold of a Kennedy, younger, perhaps a woman will be appointed. So there are a lot be determined by who is nominated, and then we'll go from there as to seeing which senators fall on which side and whether they can get enough votes to get something passed. I think if they have the votes, there'll be a new justice confirmed probably by the middle of September.
Even though that seems to be a foregone conclusion, Todd, let me poll our audience, because we live in a representative democracy here, and we know that Senator Grassley listens to Iowa Public Radio and reads the Gazette. We don't know about Mitch McConnell, so let's take a little poll. You have two choices. Who says what seems to be the course that will be taken? This nomination, this confirmation, should happen before the midterms. Applaud now. Okay, who says it must wait until after the midterms?
So I'll actually side with the audience minority. I believe Democrats are as wrong as Chuck Grassley and Mitch McConnell to demand now that this should be held up. What we have is an issue which temporarily more than likely will end some rights for some Americans. I mean, that's what the Supreme Court nomination means, and that's the end game. I mean, that's what conservatives have been working for a long time. But for Democrats to now say that we're going to push politics into the judiciary is just as bad as Chuck Grassley and Mitch McConnell doing it before. And we're running the risk of precedent. We're running the risk of an independent judiciary. They should go ahead. Trump should make his nomination. They should go ahead and hold confirmation hearings. However, they should roll back the nuclear option. It had never been used on a Supreme Court justice until last year with Neil Gorsuch.
But it had been used by the Democrats in lower courts.
It had, in lower courts and in cabinet positions, but it had never before been breached for the Supreme Court. They need to get cloture, and they need to get that three-fifths majority, those 60 votes.
I would agree with that, although I'm not sure that we aren't past the point of protecting the court from politics. You know, we've sort of given up our deference to the collective wisdom of the court as a final arbiter of what's constitutional and what's not. And everything is sort of seen through a very narrow partisan focus now. If the justices decide in your favor, it's a good decision. If Anthony Kennedy's on the other side, it's a bad decision. And I don't think that's good for the court or the public. I think it follows from our frustration with Congress getting anything done that we increasingly turn to the court to try to make change. And call me old-fashioned, but I think that the Congress should be making the laws and not the courts. But Congress can't seem to do anything, so we turn to the court for all these changes, and that's what we're left with is, you know, the people who spend millions of dollars on this confirmation battle aren't doing it because they believe in the court or justice. It's not about that. It's about partisan reasons. It's purely political.
And I believe that. I believe with Neil Gorsuch on the court is now tainted until he ages off the Supreme Court. And I want you to really hear that, because I honestly believe that the court is now tainted. It is now a political body until Neil Gorsuch is off. But right now we still have a chance that once he does age off, that we could still have an independent judiciary. If Democrats continue on the path they're on, which is the same path Republicans have already followed, we are risking an independent judiciary, and that's much more important than any give and take of individual rights that can happen in the interim.
Well, Aaron, we want to get to so many big issues. Before, in the second half of the program, we turn to sort of state issues and look at the matchups that have been revealed because of the primaries we had a couple weeks ago. But to finish up with trade, the trade war, let's just call it that. Harley Davidson in the news here. You know, apple pie, motherhood, Harley Davidson. They're pretty much all potent symbols of America. This is Donald Trump's tweet this week at Harley Davidson. A Harley Davidson should never be built in another country. Never. Their employees and customers are already very angry at them. If they move, watch. It will be the beginning of the end. They surrendered. They quit. The aura will be gone, and they will be taxed like never before. And our audience has this on our mind, right, Aaron?
That's right. We have two questions here from the audience that are related, so I'm going to throw them both out there and let our panel give their thoughts on them. Will the rural vote turn blue in 2018 and 2020 if Trump's tariffs continue? And how is Trump's ongoing tariff tirade affecting Iowa farmers?
First question, I mean, I guess that remains to be seen. I think you've seen, for now, it seems like those people are mostly trying to get along and trying to push him the right way on their issues. But if the economy continues to be bad for farms, it's hard to see them supporting the incumbent party.
There might be a few people here who are old enough to remember the 1980 grain embargo. You know, and farmers, a lot of farmers blamed that for the rural crisis in the 1980s. I don't think the evidence supports it, but there was a lot of blame put on Carter for the farm crisis. And I think it's going to be the same this time. I mean, I think farmers understand that if they can't sell their pork and their beans to China, it hurts them. And I think it's not hard to make the argument that that also hurts Main Street in a lot of small towns in Iowa and a lot of big towns. And I think this is going to be probably more of a problem for Republicans than some of the issues like immigration, because it really hits home for people in Iowa.
And you know, it isn't just the tariffs and what's going on with the taxes. It's the farm bill is being debated, and a lot of Iowa farmers aren't seeing a lot of what they want to see in that bill right now. We had the EPA come out with new volume targets for the renewable fuel standards. The EPA has said it doesn't want any comments related to the waivers it's giving to oil refineries or refineries that don't want to use corn ethanol, which directly impacts, you know, across the Midwest, corn and soybean farmers. You know, I don't know exactly how that's going to shake out, because I can see it going two different ways. I can see them being very disgruntled with individuals who supported Donald Trump and believe those promises. I can also see them wanting to stick with the devil they know, especially when that devil has seniority and might actually have a little influence in Washington, D.C. So I can see it going either way.
Well, I think elected Republican representatives in Iowa, the governor and others, are probably going to have to get tougher on the administration at some point as this goes on. I mean, I remember you mentioned the 1980s. I mean, Governor Terry Branstad told Ronald Reagan, don't come to Iowa until you fix the farm credit situation. I mean, it was a fairly strong stance against Ronald Reagan. And I remember at the time during my brother was working on elections, and I went to help him as a teenager. And he told me when we were going to parades, don't wear your Reagan Bush button because folks are not happy. So, I mean, I think we've seen letters written. We've seen people sort of wringing their hands. We've seen Joni Ernst and Chuck Grassley and others sort of, you know, expressing some sentiments to the president that, please, you know, can we not do these tariffs? Can we protect farmers? I think they're going to have to get tougher. I think they're going to have to turn up the volume, because voters are watching them and they expect strong advocates. They expect these, you know, Grassley has over the years portrayed himself as a maverick who stands up for Iowa before he stands up for his party. Well, this is the time when you have to do that kind of thing.
When I see Iowa farmers being interviewed on national media, and it could be who they're selecting, the story out of Iowa is they're worried, but they're still behind Trump. And that could be just who the national media is choosing to interview, but that's certainly what they portray on national media. I do also think that there needs to be a stronger voice from Iowa's Republicans against this. Ben Sasse, the senator from Nebraska, has written op-eds on it, and he's been a stronger voice. They are they're a consistent red state. They're not even a swing state. So I think that our Republicans in Iowa need to be more outspoken.
Is that the Ben Sasse that Iowa GOP chair Jeff Coughlin
yes.
said, don't come
yes.
here?
Yes. He's from my hometown of Fremont, Nebraska, and he has a PhD in history. And we're trying to get him to speak at Iowa State. That's one of the last things I'm trying to do before I leave is get him to speak here in October. So I'm kind of playing the hometown card and hope I'll get him.
After a short break, we'll get back to a conversation recorded last night, a lovely evening in the beer garden at Millstream Brewing in Amana, talking politics with columnist Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, and Adam Sullivan, also political reporter James Lynch, special guest Diane Bystrom, my co-host Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. When we come back, we'll focus on congressional matchups here in Iowa ahead of the general election. It's a Pints and Politics edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
We're back with a Pints and Politics edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. River to River, sort of fitting. We're next to the Mill Stream in Amana, Iowa. Mill Stream Brewing, our host today on this edition of Pints and Politics with my co-host Aaron Jordan of the Gazette, also James Lynch, Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, Adam Sullivan, all of the Gazette, and our special guest, Diane Bystrom of Iowa State University. Well, let's dig into the primary results, the matchups we have. Start at the executive level with the gubernatorial matchup we have. Fred Hubbell with a decisive 55% of the vote in our primary will be the Des Moines businessman will be up against Kim Reynolds. So let's think about this. I noticed in the Cook Political Report that they a couple of levels were jumped. It was advantage to the Republicans, to Kim Reynolds in this race after the primary. It jumped up a couple to a toss-up of 50-50. Diane, what happened there? Is it because of Fred Hubbell's money or his decisive win or both?
Well, I think some of the political pundits, especially at the national level, and I really do think the Cook Report does a good job. I mean, they have, I think, really a good methodology for running this. And it went from, I think, advantage to lean, and then it was toss-up a week. It was Friday, about a week ago Friday. And so I think what's kind of happened is that they think that there could be some baggage for Kim Reynolds. She will be an incumbent, even though she was appointed. There is an incumbency advantage, not only nationally, but Iowans really tend to like incumbents. So she'll have that going in. But I think that the notion is, I think in the Cook Report, is that, you know, she's got some things that could be problematic for her. As we've discussed before, we don't really know the impact yet of tariff and trade if we're going into the midterms. And that seems to be a problem in Iowa. I think that could hurt her. Excuse me. And I think the other thing is, I think Democrats will be fired up over the fetal heartbeat bill.
I think it's going to be an interesting contrast in both politics and personality in this race, where you have two people who, you know, both, I think, have credibility as candidates, but present real differences. And we've heard a lot about the urban-rural divide. And I think it's going to be interesting to see who can use that to their advantage, because Iowa is less and less rural as the cities grow and the rest of the state doesn't. But so many people in Des Moines and Cedar Rapids, Iowa City, and other cities came from those small towns like Amana and Norway and you know, Benton County and Iowa County and places like that. So they're still, even though they may be living in Des Moines or Cedar Rapids or Davenport, there is sort of a small town affinity, and Kim Reynolds really taps into that. Fred Hubbell really doesn't have any claim to that at all, but he presents a different style in that he comes from the business community, which typically is the community of Republicans. He's got executive experience and just a little bit of experience in state government that he can point to as his sort of his credibility to be governor.
Well, and I think for Kim Reynolds and for Republicans, I mean, it's kind of a double-edged sword. The fact that they accomplished a lot during 2 years of a legislative session and part of that time while she's governor is sort of one thing they can talk about, but it's also a disadvantage, because then if they try to run sort of a campaign that's about, well, a personality-based campaign where Kim Reynolds is more appealing than Sir Frederick, as Jeff Kaufman calls him, if they try to sort of run that kind of campaign, when you look at the substance and all of the issues that they made major moves on, voters may not buy that this is supposed to be about, well, which one of these folks do we like the best and who's got the most small town credentials and who worked at Hy-Vee, because they realize now after 2 years that there are some very big issues at stake, and that the legislature actually does things that matter. The governor signs things that matter. And so I think Republicans are going to have a rougher time making this about Fred and his riches and being out of touch and being a businessman from Des Moines when there are these really big issues that are at stake and that have been acted on during the last couple of years.
I also think that education is going to be a big issue in Iowa. It typically is in an Iowa campaign, and I think the cuts to education this year at the K-12 level and also in higher education is getting a lot of teachers motivated, and so that's why I think Rita Hart was a particularly interesting choice of Hubbell. I think it's true that lieutenant governor candidates don't make a lot of impact at the booth, but I think during the campaigning stage of it, I think she can bring some strength to the ticket by turning out rural voters as well as teachers. And I think teachers are really potent. Oklahoma, where I also lived before I moved here, had its primary on Tuesday of this week, and they had 100 school teachers running for various offices on the primary. So teachers are very motivated in a lot of states across the country. So I think that could be a real impact here if Rita Hart can turn out more people from education and younger voters and rural voters during the campaign phase, I think.
Adam, did you want to get in here?
Yeah, as folks have mentioned, I think Democrats there's signs that they're very energized this time. And on the other side of that, Democrats ran candidates in way more legislative districts than Republicans did, even a lot of races that most people think they can't win. And then Republicans actually failed to nominate someone for one of the statewide races. And so, you know, the conventional wisdom is the more candidates you have out there knocking doors for your ticket, even if they're a long shot legislative candidate, is that brings in a couple more votes for the statewide pool. And so I think that if it's going to be a close election, which I think folks think it will be at the gubernatorial level, then I think that definitely has an impact.
So this primary on June 5th, a record 84 women are going to be advancing to the November election. I wanted to ask you, Diane, what do you think this says about Iowans in terms of embracing female candidates?
Well, I think one of the things that happened is that I think a lot of women were running strategically this year. We're going to have 8 women versus women races in the general election. We had 99 candidates running, 99 women running in the primary, which is also a record. In 2016, which is the previous record year, we had 65 women on the ballot, and now we have 84. So that's and the other thing that's noteworthy looking at other states is that in some states there's also a lot of men running. So even though lots more women are running, they only are like 24% of the overall candidates in other states. In Iowa, they made up 32% during the primary stage, and because they actually had a better winning percentage than men, they have 34% during the general election phase. So they're running very well in Iowa. I'll predict here, the most number we've ever had in the state legislature of women is 35. We got that number in, I think, 2006. At the time, we were 27th in the country. Now we have 35 again because of Annette Sweeney's special election win. We were 34 before that, and we rank now 31st. So that means other states are doing better than us. But I do think that we think at the Carrie Chapman Catt Center that we could have, it's not going to be huge, but we think we might have 40 women in the legislature after the election.
If you just tuned in, Diane Bystrom with us, our special guest on this Pints and Politics edition of River to River. The Gazette partnering up with Iowa Public Radio. Aaron Jordan, my co-host. Also on our panel, James Lynch, Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, and Adam Sullivan, all of the Gazette. Specifically, let's go to the first district. I think that's deemed the most vulnerable incumbent, Rod Blum, there too. We have the Democrat, Abby Finkenauer, facing Rod Blum in the general election there. Talk about that race, because we had this Brooklyn surprise upset. Now, Abby Finkenauer, at the time she won the nomination, was said to be, if she would win, Diane, you're nodding your head, would be the youngest member of Congress, female member of Congress, maybe the one woman from Brooklyn would. We have to compare their birth dates, I guess. Have you done that?
I think Jim did. Isn't it 75 days difference?
Yeah, 75 days difference. Abby Finkenauer is older by 75 days. So even if she wins, she probably won't be the youngest woman to ever elected to Congress. What's interesting about this is I think you can draw a lot of similarities, see a lot of similarities in Abby Finkenauer and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Young, millennial women, very progressive, the difference is that the district in Brooklyn is a majority-minority district. It's younger. The first district of Iowa is older. It's almost 90% white. So it's not a case of where Abby Finkenauer fits the district better than her opponent. You probably could make the argument that Rod Blum fits the district better than Abby Finkenauer does. Mm-hmm. So I think, and not only that, but the Republican running in Brooklyn hasn't even spent $5,000 on the race yet and doesn't appear to be a significant opponent, whereas here the Republican is well-financed, is a two-term incumbent. So it's an entirely different situation in that regard. That said, this race is up for grabs.
It's going to be expensive, too, because the national parties will be pouring in the Republicans to hold on to it, the Democrats to take it away.
Yeah, there's already Abby Finkenauer and Cindy Axne have both been endorsed by Emily's List. They poured money in during the primary stage of the race. They had very well-produced ads from that perspective, I think. And also, I think they're now both red to blue by the Democratic National Committee. So there's going to be a lot of money in that race. I do think, for those that you don't see Cindy Axne's ads, you know, she's in the Des Moines media area, but she had really well-produced ads and making education sort of a central point, and also women's health care.
Cindy Axne facing David Young, the incumbent in Iowa's 3rd District.
It'd also be interesting to see, obviously, first and third district are kind of the hot targets, and Democrat resources will be to some extent split between those. But then you're also going to see a lot of, I don't know if Democrats in Iowa are going to pour money and volunteer hours into it, but J.D. Scholten, the candidate in the 4th District, he has some ability to raise money online from Democrats who really dislike Steve King. I think most people would agree that's not a winning race for him, probably. And so between governor's race, 1st District, 3rd District, and then some toss-up state legislative districts, it'll be interesting to see where parties and these outside organizations focus their resources.
And when you're looking at Brooklyn and Iowa and comparing the two, the big difference is that Brooklyn, the primary was the election. Yeah. Republicans absolutely have no chance of winning that seat unless, I don't know, an act of God, the finger comes down. Whereas the first district in Iowa is
or
competitive.
Or Putin gets involved.
Or Putin gets involved. It could happen. Some would say it's happened before. But in Iowa's first district, it doesn't matter if Abby Fichenauer is the youngest woman ever elected to Congress, or she's 35 or she's 45 or whatever, because the words used against her are always going to be that she's a young woman and too inexperienced to hold the office. And the truth is, what we have is a congressman in the first district who has angered a lot of people by not being publicly with constituents within the district. He hasn't held a town hall in over a year. In the meantime, he's privately met with different business people and people who generally agree with him and his positions throughout the district, and that hasn't settled well. It hasn't settled well with activists, and it hasn't settled well with general people who hear about it.
Well, and he's sort of adopted the... He's sort of adopted, Rod Blum sort of adopted kind of a Trumpian mode to criticism. I mean, when stories come out that he doesn't like, or columns come out that he doesn't like, or editorials, he basically attacks the publications or the reporters, or he storms out of questioning. And I mean, that's probably his Achilles heel, as he seems like he might be sort of a thin-skinned congressman. But I mean, I don't know how Abby Finkenhauer is going to capitalize on that, but I think there's going to be plenty of money pumped into that district, and I think he'll have plenty of charges to be mad about by the time November rolls around, if it's like any of the other swing districts we've seen.
You just tuned in. It's a Pints and Politics edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. Iowa Public Radio teaming up with the Gazette for another edition of Pints and Politics. Todd Dorman, Adam Sullivan, Linda Waddington, James Lynch of the Gazette, my co-host Aaron Jordan, also of the Gazette, and our special guest Diane Bystrom. Beautiful setting this evening, a little bit sticky, but still very pleasant as we enjoy our pints out here on the lawn of Millstream Brewing in Amana, next to Millstream. And I look out, it's sort of murky, which brings us to something that has been on the minds of Iowans for a long time and on the minds of more than at least one of our audience members out there. Did you have the question? It has to do with water quality. We passed our legislature and was signed into law a new water quality bill. What's the status there, or do we have a more specific question?
The specific question from the audience is, what can we do to influence decisions made about environmental issues?
Well, I mean, the easiest answer is to pin candidates down and vote for the candidates who answer the questions in a way that indicates that they care about the issue. I mean, that's...
What would you pin them down on?
I think, you know, I know we have a monumental water quality bill that was signed earlier this year. Unfortunately, it doesn't really do much more than sort of spend some money on some projects. The success is going to be measured by counting those projects, not by necessarily testing water to see if it's still polluted, which is a downside. But I guess as I think about this, here's the question that I would ask. Can we continue to have a voluntary program forever? Can we continue to tell farmers, well, you can reduce nitrates and phosphorus, or if you don't want to, you don't have to? I mean, that's the program that we have right now. And if we're not going to continue to allow this voluntary program, at what point do we make it mandatory, and how do you make it mandatory? I mean, that's sort of the question, because we've got a University of Iowa study that's come out in the last few weeks that shows, despite all of the efforts, that our share of nitrate flowing into the Mississippi and onto the dead zone has actually increased. So I understand that there are farmers doing the right thing. There are people doing cover crops and grass buffer strips and putting in wood chip bioreactors at the outlets of their tile and all of these things that you hear about. But the fraction of the folks that are doing that is still so small that it's not moving the needle. at what point do we adopt policy that says, look, this is a problem. Here is a menu of things you need to do. You can choose from that menu. You can make a plan that fits your farm, but you're going to have to do something. You can't just continue to sort of, you know, wait for your neighbors or wait for someone to pay you more money to do it. I mean, you have to do something. Politicians in Iowa have been very reluctant to do that. I think if you want to move the needle on water quality, you have to look for politicians that aren't reluctant to do that.
And the next question you have to ask is one you ask yourself. How much are you willing to pay for that? It's a like estimated to be a $45 billion problem.
Right.
How much are you willing to pay to have clean water?
This has been an easy issue for Democrats to beat up Republicans about, but we met with all of the Democrats running for governor. None of them said they were willing to jump right in right away and have a mandatory program. I've spoken to several more Democrat legislators. Very, very few of them say that they will vote for a mandatory program right now. So it'll be interesting to see if Democrats do take one or both chambers of the legislature, whether they'll put forth a mandatory program, which I think most of the hardcore advocates agree is necessary. It's more likely that they'll put in some kind of benchmarks and some kind of monitoring program, but I don't think there's really any assurance that that would work any better than what we have now.
Well, I wanted to step away from water quality for a minute. Today, this afternoon, we were kind of learning news breaking about a shooting in a newspaper office in Annapolis, which of course strikes home for me as a newspaper reporter. But we also, you know, it's periodically on our minds as other shootings happen. Recently, as part of March for Our Lives, there were students from Parkland, Florida, who visited Eastern Iowa during a tour. They stopped at a store in Cedar Rapids. They stopped at Linmar High School. There were protests held outside Steve King's office in Sioux City. What do you see as the goals of the visit? I mean, is it political, you know, and are Iowans receptive? Diane, I don't know if you want to take this first.
Well, of course, as I tell people, I work at Iowa State, and I work with very motivated students. The students that are connected with the CAT Center and the Leadership Studies program have always been very politically motivated. We do a lot of civic engagement. We do voter registration. I feel like the students are very much engaged. I'm in the baby boomer population, and we actually now are not the largest population generation in the United States. Millennials are, but they turn out to vote in very low numbers. If millennials voted, our world would be much different. And so I do think these Parkland students have really engaged younger voters about the importance of voting. And so I think that's going to be a good thing. You know, and I also kind of want to throw out here, I think we have another election on the ballot that's an interesting one with a different kind of strategy, and that's Deidre Jagier and the Secretary of State's office against Paul Pate. And actually, Paul, you know, the time I've been at the CAT Center, there's only been two Secretary of States that have ever reached out to Iowa State on wanting to get young voters involved. One is Chet Culver, a Democrat, but Paul Pate has done things to register voters. Young voters. On the other hand, we have this new Voter Integrity Act, which when I talked to Paul about it, I said, gee, we were ranked third in the country in voter integrity when we, you know, passed this law, so are we trying to be number one? And so I do think voting rights are going to be a motivational factor with young people. The young people at Iowa State are very upset with the Voter Integrity Act because it does put a lot of more restrictions on particularly college voters and also minority and older voters.
The sun is on its way to setting here in Amana, and so is our discussion. We've run out of time. I'm sure we'll mingle afterwards and continue our discussion, but for the sake of this broadcast, I wanted to end on a lighter note. We've been into some heavy topics, and we've had some great insights from our panel. The other bit of news that was focused on quite a bit over the last few days is Melania Trump's jacket. The jacket that read, "I don't really care, do you?" This was on her way to visit an immigrant children separated from their families, seemingly a contradictory message to the one she wanted to send on her mission to Texas. The First Lady spokeswoman dismissed the idea that there was anything wrong with this jacket. It's a jacket. There was no hidden message, according to the spokeswoman. So, to our panel here, if you're spry enough to jump on this in a short fashion in the time we have remaining, if you were to wear a jacket, what message would you have on the back of it, and where would you be going? Adam Sullivan.
My jacket says, "End the Fed," and I would walk up and down Constitution Avenue.
Any other takers?
My jacket would say, elections matter, and I'd walk around first Iowa State University.
Yeah, I think what mine would say, stop focusing on trivia, and then I would, I'd probably take it off because it's summer.
Yeah. I think I borrow a page from Amy Nielsen, Iowa House representative, and I would wear a T-shirt that says, government smells small, it would fit in your uterus, and I would wear it in the Iowa Capitol.
I'd wear a peace symbol. Wear it anywhere.
Okay. Thanks to our panel. Thanks, everybody, for turning out tonight.
And that ends the discussion recorded last night in the Beer Garden at Millstream Brewing in Mana. Thanks so much to Millstream Brewing for hosting us on that lovely evening. Another edition of Pints and Politics presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. Joining me of the Gazette, Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, Adam Sullivan, James Lynch, and Aaron Jordan. Our special guest, Diane Bystrom. Emily Woodbury produced and edited this hour. Our sound engineer was Jim Davies. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.